This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Eliza Hittman delivers a masterwork in Never Rarely, Sometimes Always, while Pete Davidson commits to his bad influence persona in Big Time Adolescence. And yes, we are finally back and we are properly socially distanced for this episode. We are not hunched over one mic together, and we're going to be talking about a pair of films today in addition to what else we've been doing and watching to occupy our time. But I'm going to get things started by talking about Big Time Adolescence, which some of you may have seen because it's currently streaming on Hulu. And as mentioned in the intro, it is a vehicle for Pete Davidson. And there's literally never been a more Pete Davidson role than this. Essentially, the film centers on a high school student named Mo, played by Griffin Gluck. He's only ever had one real friend, who happens to be his sister's ex, Zeke, who was the aforementioned Pete Davidson. And of course, Zeke is much older than him, and he takes Mo to bars and drinking and smoking with him constantly, despite Mo being underage. So safe to say, he plays a Pete Davidson-type character, and he's just a bad influence on this kid. Then eventually, the story progresses to the point where Zeke tasks Mo with bringing booze and selling drugs at his senior high school parties. And as you can imagine, it doesn't end well. And just overall, this is sort of a solid little indie coming-of-age story. It never truly moves into great territory, but it never really tries to, and you could do a lot worse for entertainment purposes, especially given our current situation. But I was impressed with a few supporting roles. First off, John Cryer is in this film, and he's playing Mo's father. I mean, it's actually a solid fatherly role. It's nice to see him out of the trappings of his usual, you know, Two and a Half Men stuff. And I don't know, I thought he really brought it in a different way. And he has a couple of good scenes where he sort of has a face-to-face with Pete Davidson for being this bad influence. And I thought he actually had some bitingly funny lines as well. So it was just nice to see him in a different mindset. And, you know, like I alluded to, this isn't exactly a stretch of a role. To see Pete Davidson playing a jobless young adult with a drug habit who happens to be friends with Machine Gun Kelly. Because, yes, Machine Gun Kelly is in this film as well as one of Zeke's friends. And he's solid. It's a very small supporting role, but he's fun to watch. And it's interesting to see that their friendship has constantly carried over to a variety of films. I will say that, you know, I thought there was a few moments where there was a couple of pretty funny edits in the film. There's this cut to Zeke singing karaoke, which is weird, the similarities these two films have, because this is where the similarities end, that they both have a karaoke scene, and that's pretty much it. Although I guess the argument could be made that they're both coming-of-age films. This is definitely a more of a broadly comedic one, to say the least. There's also this interesting artistic choice when, towards the climax, Zeke is trying to save Mo and get him away from the party, from the cops hunting him down, and there's this cut. I'm blanking on the song choice right now, but safe to say it was not a song you expect in this film, definitely of the older school of variety, but there was a couple choices that, safe to say, I thought elevated the trappings. There's also a solid supporting role from Una Lawrence as the love interest for Mo, but unfortunately she doesn't really get a big sort of resolution to their arc because she's sort of left by the side. And honestly, it's sort of reflective of the path sort of our lead character of Mo goes down. So it actually is true to it in that sense. But overall, like I said, I think it's a solid movie. You know, there's some funny moments. It's not anything great, but you can do a lot worse for entertainment. I will say one of the big credits I do give to the film and that I admire about it is that they left it on a sort of downer ending without any sort of big redemptive conclusion, which I really admired and did not expect from a film like this. So as I mentioned, you know, this is currently streaming on Hulu, so you can definitely check it out. I know it's one of their most streamed movies, although shout out to Parasite for being their most highly watched foreign independent film ever. So that's great to hear. But I guess I'll turn it over to Ryan to hear what he's been doing to occupy his time in the doldrums of self-isolation.
Jesus, Andrew, this has really been something, huh?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so in this time of uncertainty and anxiety and not knowing when any of it is ever going to kind of snap to, and things are going to stop being horrendous on a daily basis, I find it very hard to actually concentrate on anything that requires a lot of brain power, which is why I'm really glad I was able to force myself to sit through our second film that we'll be getting to. But I've done a lot of casual watching, just there's really not a hell of a lot to do. I'm only working Tuesdays and Thursdays right now. I am very fortunate to still have a job and to still be getting my full paycheck. My grant for my program is extended through October. So it's good to know that I actually have some security, especially when so many others may not be as lucky. And with that weighing on me, it's been hard to even know where to start. So I just did some what I ultimately decided was trash movie watching. And I started with Anthony Minghella's The Talented Mr. Ripley, which I had never seen before. And I know that it might be a little dickish to put it in the trash pile, but the movie has not aged well. It's about 21 years old by this point. And when I say it hasn't aged well, I mean that it's like this. That quintessential 90s style that you fucking know. It's like the upper middle brow movie. It's hard to think of another one, or I guess like maybe Elizabeth from the year before. It's that awards bait movie that's kind of edgy and has up and coming actors in it. It's just overacted, overblown, overdirected, too much style. I mean, even Philip Seymour Hoffman's campy performance can't really save it towards the end. And that's going to go ditto for the other movie I watched, which was fucking Jerry Maguire. I'm just going to say I had never seen this film before. Within 5 minutes, I hated it. And that did not get much better throughout the course of the film. Pure hate watch, pure trash. I don't understand. Like some of the like I feel that a lot of stupid action movies. Like I caught Metro with Eddie Murphy on HBO recently, and that movie has aged a shitload better. I don't know if it's because it was bad in the first place, and that kind of kitschy 90s style works for a movie like that. But when you see what we held up in such high esteem back then, it just kind of falls apart. But this is like these weren't the doldrums of filmmaking. We had movies like Being John Malkovich, Eyes Wide Shut, Magnolia, the year Talented Mr. Ripley came out. I don't understand. All About My Mother, Pedro Almodóvar. I don't understand how like that movie was still like considered part of that crew. But moving on, in addition to that, I've been trying to catch up with some TV as well. Specifically, all right. So I think it's a really entertaining documentary series. Your mileage is probably going to vary on that. But I've been checking out Dark Side of the Ring on Viceland. This is basically just about the behind the scenes stuff. Each episode focuses on a notorious real life issue that happened behind the scenes in pro wrestling. It ranges from hilarious to devastating, depending on the episode. But if you are of any interest in that backstage Machiavellian politics stuff and of real life crime tragedy, you can do a lot better than Tiger King and check out Dark Side of the Ring instead. And also, just for the hell of it, I know Andrew was dreading me mentioning this, but I checked out a movie called No Holds Barred starring Hulk Hogan back. This movie fucking came out, I think I want to say 1988, 89 at the height of Hulkamania. And I don't even know how to begin to describe it, but it's basically Hulk Hogan plays a fictionalized main character. I don't know why they weren't allowed to use the name Hulk Hogan in the script because everyone else's name was the same. And he wrestles this new wrestler named Zeus, who is played by Tiny Lister in the film. And then that was actually used to set up a match at SummerSlam. So basically, the premise of that match was the actor who plays Zeus was upset that he got beat in the movie, which was a movie, and he wanted to get a one-up victory over Hulk Hogan in real life. If you can follow that any better than I can, then you're of saner mind than I. But again, going back, like there's trash and then there's No Holds Barred. This movie is just like the most pure, virile, immature bullshit that spews out of Vince McMahon's head. And you got to be really drunk for it, but damn it if I didn't have fun watching it. And finally, I just want to say that I was able to get around to a movie that we did not get to last year. We had other things to do, and this one, something about it just seemed really weird. And I watched it just to confirm, but I watched Danny Boyle's yesterday as well. And this is for those of you who don't remember, it's basically this kid who gets hit by a bus, and when he wakes up, no one remembers the Beatles. So he steals all their song and he becomes a millionaire, and Ed Sheeran's in it, and he tries to get him to change Hey Jude to Hey Dude. And it's written by the guy who, Richard Curtis, a man responsible for that war crime of a film, Love Actually. Yesterday is, all right, so it stars this guy named Himesh Patel. I was unfamiliar with him going in. He carries the movie and he makes it absolutely watchable and entertaining. He's a very solid actor and he had absolutely nothing to work with. So kudos there. But it's just like there's so many weird sub subplots running through it. Like, it's a really a romance. Lily James plays his girlfriend, and she was always his manager when he was a struggling singer-songwriter, and now he's leaving her for the big time and Ed Sheeran and all this. There's a subplot where these two people who are stalking him now all of a sudden because they remember the Beatles and they thought they were going crazy, and they just want to corner him and thank him. And then, you know, it's the will he, won't he of actually revealing that these songs were not by him. There's a really just whacked out scene where he fucking tracks down a still alive John Lennon living on the, played by Richard Carlyle, living on a beach somewhere. This movie is pure insanity. It takes a lot of missteps, but I wasn't bored by it. And that's really the best thing I can say. And I know that was kind of a long-winded rant and trying to cram a little into a short time. I didn't even touch upon WrestleMania 7, where Sergeant Slaughter started sympathizing with Kuwait, the traitor. But, you know, that's probably a conversation for another time. Andrew, what are some of the things that you've been catching up on?
Oh, God, yeah. How can I possibly follow that? For a second, when you were bringing up wrestling, I thought for sure you were going to talk about the new top streamer on Netflix, The Big Show Show. With The Big Show starring in essentially what amounts to a Full House reboot. Oh, wait, they already did that.
Get the fuck out of here. No, absolutely not.
No, the only reason I mentioned that is because I saw the trailer for it, and then I saw it in Netflix's top 10 streaming, and I'm like, geez, look, I couldn't lose more faith in humanity as it is. But I did not. No, I did not watch that show. I watched some high art. And then I also watched some other stuff. I watched a pair of films from a filmmaker who I finally started to get into last summer, when I had sort of a self-induced isolation after I was in a car accident and I couldn't go anywhere. Now I have, times have changed. But last summer I first got into iconic art house filmmaker Wong Kar-wai. And this past couple weeks I did catch up on a couple more of his films, starting with Happy Together, as well as Fallen Angels. And Happy Together is, you know, really an incredible film. It's about, you know, focus on a homosexual relationship between two men. And it's told in the classic, incredibly visual way that Wong Kar-wai does. And essentially these two men are sort of holed up in a foreign country for them, and they're sort of stuck there, and we get to see their romance essentially fall apart with just great panache, great storytelling, great visuals. And it's just like, I mean, I'm just like, I'm one of these people, and like Ryan and I've talked about on this podcast before, sometimes no matter how much we watch, there's always going to be filmmaker blind spots. And I just can't believe it's taken me this long to find Wong Kar-wai, because he's instantly up in my top five favorite filmmakers easily at this point. And then Fallen Angels, I mean, Jesus. I mean, this was sort of a change of pace for Wong Kar-wai at the time, where he's sort of, you know, because most of his films center on romance and sort of breaking down a lot of these different relationships. But Fallen Angels continues that, but does so in a criminal setting where we have hitmen, you know, and just crazy, wild character. I don't even know how to describe it. I can't possibly put it into words, but essentially we have this hitman character, and then we have sort of this woman who's his backer. And then we have this other character who's just scraping by and doing all these insane things to get people to either buy papers from him, or he's like stealing people's businesses just trying to get by. And it's weird how these things connect, but they do, and it just works in only the way Wong Kar-wai can pull off. So those are two great films I watched. I also decided to, you know, this has been on my list for a while, but I wanted to finally catch up on random James Bond films that I have not seen. And I started, of course, at the beginning, because I had never seen Dr. No from director Terrence Young, who directed a number of other Bond films later in the series. And safe to say, he improved greatly on his formula, because while I enjoyed this film, and it's definitely really fits in at the time it was made, to say the least, this was baffling in a lot of different ways. I've seen many people talk about how, like it's ironic that the Bond filmography, this film was released in 1962, and it's ironic that the Bond series became as popular as it did after this film, because we have Sean Connery in there, and we have the classic, you know, theme, of course, when we have a few different things that are established. But a lot of, you know, the standbys of the series weren't really completely established until the next few films in this series. So it's really weird to watch, you know, this take place. As essentially, as the title suggests, we have Bond facing off against Dr. No, who literally is not even revealed. He's not even in the film until the last, like, 15 minutes or so. I believe, and essentially it just amounts to Sean Connery going around flirting with women, not doing much of anything. And despite all that, I enjoyed it somewhat. I think it was just because it's such a relic of its time, you know, it was hard not to enjoy, you know, on some level. But safe to say, the series has greatly improved. And even as goes as far as to say, the second film in the series, From Russia with Love, starring Sean Connery, once again, is a massive improvement on that. I watched that film a number of years ago, and it's certainly one of the better entries in the series, to say the least. But people who hold up Dr. No as one of the best in the series, they've got issues, because the film doesn't make any sense, but I enjoyed it, despite all of that. But with that in mind, I did want to turn our attention to at least one news story before we transition to our second film of the day. I was telling Ryan about this before, and only I would bring this up because only I would get indignant over the fact that Disney is once again doing a live-action remake of one of their animated films. But safe to say, it's a film I'm more connected to because it's adapting my favorite, and I know this is a very controversial take, my favorite animated Disney film, which is Robin Hood, 1973. Yes, it's the one with the animals and the fox. But apparently they announced this, and it seems like it's going to be a Disney Plus, thing. So I guess it'd be more in line with that Lady and the Tramp movie they made, which I will probably never watch. But this, the interesting thing about this is when news dropped, I believe it was earlier this week or the end of last week, it was announced that Blindspotting director Carlos Lopez Estrada had signed on to take the helm. And for those of you who are longtime listeners of this podcast, you know of both Ryan and I's absolute adoration for Blindspotting, starring the great David Diggs. Just an incredible piece of work. But I can't help it but be a bit cynical about this, because from the articles I was reading, apparently they're planning on going the Lion King route. And, you know, it's safe to say that greatly worries me, because the Lion King remake is one of the biggest travesties in the art form of film, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it loses all the magic of the original. It doesn't even know that To Be Prepared is an iconic song, and doesn't understand that. It completely misuses the likes of freaking Donald Glover and Beyonce. I don't know how that's even possible, but it's the truth. And it's just sorely lacking any sort of magic whatsoever. Now, I do have, you know, there's a part of me that thinks, oh, well, they got a good filmmaker, and maybe because this isn't, you know, maybe not going to be seen in theaters. I don't know that for sure, but it seems like from what they were saying, it's more of a Disney Plus thing. Maybe it'll allow the filmmaker to be more creative, but who am I kidding? Disney's Disney, and they're going to get their greedy hands all over it and ruin other things like that they've ruined like in recent years with many blockbuster franchises, which I will not get into right now. But Ryan, do you have any thoughts on my ramblings?
You know, I think my feelings about live, quote unquote, live action Disney remakes are pretty well documented. Like you said, I'm going to kind of reserve judgment just because it's Carlos Lopez Estrada, and Blindspotting is just, for my money, it's an absolute masterpiece and was one of my favorite films of the last decade. But you don't know when he's working under a different, you know, this isn't a movie that he did himself and then is shopping around at Sundance. This is Disney. Disney owns all now, and I'm wondering how they're going to clip his wings, so to speak, or in some ways tap into his talents. I don't want to be 100% cynical about that, but unfortunately, I think history is just going to kind of prove us right on that one.
Yeah, I definitely don't think you're wrong in that. But I guess we can turn our attention to our main event of the evening, which is a really incredible piece of work from filmmaker, writer, director Eliza Hittman, and this is a film titled Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, which I believe is the most critically acclaimed film of the year to date, however you categorize scientifically, you know, how these reviews work. But this is an absolute fucking masterwork as far as I'm concerned. And I haven't seen any of her previous work. I know Ryan may get into a bit of that. But essentially, this film centers on a pair of teenage girls in rural Pennsylvania who travel to New York City to seek out medical help after an unintended pregnancy. And I say to say it goes, you know, a lot more in depth than that. But what I was completely blown away by in this film is that I don't think a lot of people will truly be able to understand, unless you're really into this type of stuff or really into the art form, I don't think you'll really understand how difficult it is to create a film like this that is so full of layered emotion, but with such sparse dialogue. And even the words that are spoken and said are superfluous in a lot of ways and don't tell the whole story. The visuals and the performances are really telling the whole story. And what I mean by that is, you know, it's really all about subtext. You know, a lot of the words that are spoken aren't really giving us the full picture. It's the looks from characters. It's the cinematography that elevates really simple moments. And it's just an incredible piece of work. There's an incredible lead performance from actress Sydney Flanagan. And this happens to be her only ever acting credit as our lead, Autumn. Her face, you know, tells the story throughout. There's an incredible unbroken shot at a certain point where we get to hear the title of this film over and over again. And she also she also gets to put her singing talents on full display in the film. And she's just really, really incredible in the film. But I'll turn it over to Ryan as we'll go a bit back and forth on this one.
This is a film that really, if there was ever a film that ever felt timeless, not just of the moment, but like completely timeless, I think this would be the one. And this is a movie that it's just kind of unfortunate that it got taken, that it took this long to have this experience on screen. And I think the film is very tender in the way that it approaches it. And I mean, it's one of the most traumatic things that a woman could go through. And I think that there's a lot of misinformation out there about what the process is. And I think that there's just a lot of ignorance about what certain women do have to go to. I mean, you and I live in a blue state with access to healthcare should someone need it. But other states might have draconian laws or, you know, for whatever reason, a person might have to flee to somewhere else to go get this procedure taken care of. But I was just struck by like the intimacy of the film. And like you said, the whole thing is just told through expressions and the dialogue just doesn't really seem here or there, to be honest. And that's totally fine. Most of the time, it kind of blends in with the sound design as it is. It's just background noise to what is actually, you know, always on the forefront. I think this is a very oppressive film in a lot of ways because it's just so steeped in that trauma. You know, it's always lurking just around the bend. We see a lot of, you know, handsy men and men who are sexually harassing them on the streets. One guy is masturbating in front of them on the subway. I mean, it's just very disgusting in what is actually put on screen, but it's something that felt wholly necessary. I mean, it's hard to wrap your mind around because it is just such, you know, big in scale, and you don't want to necessarily go in one direction or the other when commenting on this film. But I do think that taking this empathetic approach and showing that, you know, there are reasons that some states are permissive about certain things, and I think it takes, with that empathy, it just creates an argument. And you're 100% right, the film is an absolute masterpiece, but I think it prevents an argument for a woman's right to healthcare that has never been put on screen. It doesn't have any rah-rah moments or anything like that. It's just a very sincere, lived-in and humanistic film, and that's it hit me in a very specific way. I haven't seen anything like this, maybe in terms of the way that the dialogue is presented, maybe since even the Florida Project, going back that far. And, you know, you mentioned some of Hittman's earlier work. I did see Beach Rats within the past few months. Also completely stellar work about a kid coming up in Brooklyn who's a closeted gay, and just how he kind of wrestles with that and the toxic masculinity around him. So I think within two films, Hittman is really just like, it's a shame that these films haven't gotten bigger audiences yet, because she is actually doing absolute yeoman's work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to obviously single out, I already mentioned some of the cinematography, but there's absolutely consistently unbelievable cinematography from a French cinematographer, I may butcher her name, Helene Louvart. There are so many memorable shots in this film. There's this one that was etched into my mind, apart from a few really incredible unbroken shots. There's this one shot where Autumn is getting a sonogram and the camera follows her gaze to the sky. essentially it looks like a sky, you know, but it's a painted ceiling, you know, with a light blue sky and clouds. And it's just really evocative stuff that is hard to get out of your mind. There's this great sort of echoing. There's a few couple sequences where there's like she's getting a procedure done. She's having her handheld during the procedure. And that's echoed by this incredible moment later on when her friend Skylar, played by Talia Ryder, is sort of having a different experience, to say the least. And I don't know, there's just such simple, you know, it just really creates a really intimate environment between the audience and the characters. And that's not just due to the camera's proximity, although a lot of that is utilized with a focus on faces and simple movements of bodies throughout. But you also called attention to the portrayal of the male creeps throughout the film. I loved that because it was so simply done. Like, it wasn't overwrought or anything, but it was just presented, like, you know, when they're working at the grocery store, we have that creep manager who, like, kisses their hands when they're turning in their collected you know, drawers after counting their money. And there's just really simple portrayals of that that I think just go a long way of taking on sort of the male gaze, so to speak. And also, as I alluded to earlier in with my thoughts on Big Time Adolescence, the only thing that's really in common with both these films is they both have sort of, although this film, to say, has a much more memorable karaoke sequence. But yes, they both have karaoke scenes. And this one, good God, like, it's another one of those sort of shots that just focuses on actress Sydney Flanagan. And like I said, I was blown away that this is her only acting credit, but also not in a sense, because, you know, you can clearly see that the filmmaker wanted this to feel really lived in and real. And so it's to her benefit that she casts actors who don't have a lot of experience. And just her rendition of the Jerry and the Pacemakers classic, "Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying," was hard to get out of my head afterwards, to say the least. And it shows that karaoke is a truly underrated trope that can be used for immense emotional power.
Yes, that scene is an absolute knockout. And there was one other scene, and I guess really it's kind of a collection of scenes that I want to highlight too. You mentioned that kind of raw lived-in feel. I think I had read previously that Hitman had cast a lot of the real-life healthcare workers to act in this film, just to kind of give it as much authenticity as possible. And I think that definitely reads through on the screen. I mean, there's an absolutely phenomenal scene where, and just absolutely devastating, heart-wrenching, where she's kind of going through a questionnaire with a mental health worker when she first gets to the clinic. And just, as you know, obviously where they get the title, "We're going to ask you these questions," and you answer "never," "rarely," "sometimes," "always." And just as the questions kind of play out, and that devastation just kind of comes, just starts reading on Flanagan's face. And, you know the answers to the questions without her even having to say a word. It's just so impactful. And it is so haunting. Like, I had literally had to just sit in silence for about 10 minutes after the movie. It's an absolute gut punch. But I think it is that realness and that rawness that makes it connect so well. And I know it probably won't change anyone's mind politically, but hopefully it makes them feel just, you know, a little bit differently about the person on the other end of that.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm definitely looking forward to checking out her other work, particularly Beach Rats. And I know she made a film earlier. I think it's something to the effect of "It Felt Like Love" or something like that. I know. So I'm really looking forward to checking it out. And, you know, for film nerds like ourselves, like I was telling Ryan beforehand, like, after I watched this film last night, I was just like so inspired. And I went on a tear with writing for a few hours. And that's always encouraging, especially in these times where sometimes it can be a mental struggle, to say the least. Mm-hmm. So just having, you know, and I know you said sometimes it's hard to focus on these things, and I definitely completely agree with you in that perspective. But yeah, it just really shows the power of a great work of art, to say the least. But with that in mind, I guess we can turn our attention, and we're going to talk a little bit about, Ryan already provided a very good tease for what we're going to do next in that middle section, because he talked about a few films that will no doubt come out, because I had this idea a few weeks ago that, you know, obviously in these times, there are some films coming to different streaming services and video on demand services, you know, and films being directly dropped to video on demand. But, you know, I can't say I'm inkling to get out there and watch Trolls World Tour anytime soon. safe to say we're going to be doing some really creative episodes. And these are always my, I think, my favorite types of episodes when we do something different. And I always love our discussions of current films, but it can be really fun when we get to completely nerd out. So Ryan talked about a couple films from the year 1999, and my brilliant idea is that we're going to do sort of a series, and we don't have any specific plan at this point other than this first one, but my plan is to go as it does, try and make this podcast, you know, consistent again after our sort of, you know, month hiatus, because we've got to stay sane somehow. And what better way than to throw ourselves into our film nerddom? But essentially, I had this idea for an episode entitled The Year in Film That Was 1999. So essentially, we're going to be picking out specific years in film, and 1999 is one that's always been held up, you know, by cinephiles as one of the great years in film. And we're definitely going to put that to task and see how well it holds up. Ryan already alluded to a couple of films that perhaps do not hold up as well from that particular year or and as well as time period. But essentially, my vision for this idea is that, you know, we're going to spend the first half of the episode talking in general about films we like, films that haven't aged well, etc. And then we're going to do what I like to call the revisionist history Oscars. As you guys know, we've talked about the Oscars on this podcast previously, but this is really going to put them to task, where we're going to take a look at all the nominees from that particular year, who won, etc., and we're going to make our own choices on who should have won. And my idea behind it is to make it a bit game-like, where we're not going to necessarily do every single category, but we're going to call out, you know, a particular number of categories. It may be 10 for one year, maybe more for another year. It really depends year by year. And we'll be sort of picking, you know, either our choice from the nominations, or we'll even throw in a few wild cards to make it fun. If we could pick something off the board, who would we choose to win a particular category? And safe to say, as soon as this idea popped into my mind, I got incredibly excited about it. And I know Ryan and I, safe to say, I'm sure it's going to go off the rails, but I know it's going to be a blast to record these episodes for sure.
Oh, hell yeah, it is. I can't wait for that. 99 really was kind of a formulative year for me. I was 13 years old, and that's when I really, really started to kind of start sinking my teeth into film. But yeah, it's going to be fun to take a look back on that. And before we part for this evening, and this was really fun to do and to kind of get back into something resembling something I used to do, something normal, you know, I did want to make mention of someone that we have actually lost to COVID-19. Obviously, I will briefly discuss that elephant in the room. But Adam Schlesinger, who was the songwriter for the band Fountains of Wayne, was actually a ghostwriter for a lot of movie songs as well. None more iconic or better than That Thing You Do, which is for the titular Tom Hanks film. But he didn't just do that song. He did the entire soundtrack, Little Wild One, All My Only Dreams. All those songs that are ingrained in my brain. That's my most watched movie. I wore that VHS out when I was a kid. Every time it's on Stars or HBO or whatever, I'll just toss it on randomly. I own the DVD back in the day. Never bought the Blu-ray for some reason, but might as well pick it up at this point. And I know that tomorrow, the four actors from the film are going to be doing a YouTube watch along, providing commentary to the film. And I think that's on at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. I'll probably be checking it out because, you know, I'll be home. Oh, actually, my mistake. It's going to be on Friday, this coming Friday, the 17th. But it's, you know, it's just really it'd be nice to pay tribute. And they're going to be raising money for research for a vaccine for COVID-19 and donating that money to a company that's working on that. But it's just it'll be nice to pay tribute to a man who really just pulled off an absolute filmmaking miracle by writing a song that we had to hear in different iterations multiple times throughout the course of the film, had to be catchy enough, and it had to be believable as something that actually would have come out in the mid-60s at the height of Beatlemania. And he just nailed it. He absolutely fucking nailed it. I've never seen anyone do something so perfect that is essentially background dressing in a film. Even if it is at the forefront, it is essentially secondary to what happens on screen. And it's just an absolute miracle. And you know what? To that end, I am very grateful for that, and I hope he rests in peace, and it's a shame that he had to go this way.
Yeah, I couldn't echo Ryan's thoughts more. You know, this is definitely something that, you know, we've always shared our love of That Thing You Do. It's also a film that I watched way too much growing up, to say the least. And I just echo all of your thoughts. I was so encouraged after that, because it's hard to be, you know, after something so tragic happens like that. But I was so encouraged because there was a lot of great articles written, you know, on many different sites that really broke down and those thoughts that you just mentioned, how the song had to be so catchy. But you had to not be able to get sick of it. There's this great article that was written on The Ringer in particularly, but there was so many tributes pouring out there. And yeah, I was going to echo that as well. And of course, call attention to the great reunion that they're doing for such a great cause. So yeah, I mean, I couldn't echo those thoughts more. Obviously, we've lost, you know, a lot of people to this unfortunate virus, but it's always encouraging when people can take something as tragic as that and, you know, come together for a good cause in the end. But with that in mind, I guess we'll turn our attention to our next episode. Like I said, we're going to try and make this a regular thing, and we'll be coming back with our thoughts on the year in film that was 1999. See you guys next episode.